Is any part of you thinking, I'm different, I can't control this, I got this?
You do until you buy drugs for the first time.
Right.
You believe it until, like, you kind of turn to the guy who, like, has the blow, and you're like, all right, give me a bump. You know, that's what they call it, addiction. Once it's back, you don't care. You want more of it. And it sounds so crazy sitting here sober to say, why would you want more of being the guy grinding his teeth in the corner of the whatever? That's it. You, as soon as you do it, you want more, and all logic and reason goes out the window.
That's the voice of Paul H. He's been sober since October 1st, 2020. My name is Mike, and this is Keep Coming Back, Real Stories of Sobriety and Recovery. So the reason that I was laughing when Paul said, you think you have it under control until you buy drugs for the first time, was really for two reasons. First and foremost, I was the king of making these internal deals with myself and promises to myself, especially in the last few years of my using. And they usually revolved around me saying, if I do blank, then I'll have to quit drinking. And the blank was usually cocaine or Oxycontin or ketamine or whatever was in sort of the 6 months rotation. I noticed that the first 6 months of whatever substance I was using, especially cocaine, were usually amazing. I look back and think, if only it could go back to those 6 months. And the problem was I would just abuse it until it wasn't or it stopped working. Now, breaking these sort of self-imposed rules was meant to force my hand into being fully sober. I would say, like, okay, if you do cocaine again, you have to quit drinking. But the truth was I wouldn't do it, and then it would just would make me feel worse about myself. So that was the cycle that I was on. And the second reason I laughed was because me and Paul, we talk a lot about relapse during this interview. Now, he's been sober 11 months now, but he had several years. And in between, there was a 21-month relapse. And I think that the fantasy for every addict, I know that it is for me, is that I could simply just go back to drinking and that I could do it normally and have a glass of wine by the fireplace or just have a beer out on a hot day. And the truth is that I tried that experiment and it didn't work for me. But I think the fantasy is that I could just put those substances I used to do on the shelf, drink like a gentleman, as the book says, and things would be normal. Unfortunately, it just doesn't work that way for me. Now, in this interview, me and Paul talk about what led to that relapse. We talk about how hard it was to come back from it. And importantly, we talk about what makes this run of sobriety unique versus the first go around. And so with that, because we did say a lot, let's get to my interview with Paul H. Here's what I always found interesting. We met in a meeting, right? When you're amongst other people in AA, amongst other alcoholics, you can look at each other and everyone understands exactly why we did the things we did over, like you said, over 100 times. When there was glaring stop signs and flashing yellows to stop, right? So if the layman person, if the normal person went up to you and was like, hey man, like, I'm not understanding. When you take drugs and alcohol, crazy shit happens. So why didn't you just stop? What would you have said?
You think that the way to solve the worst of it is to do more of it. You're convinced
right.
of that.
Right.
And it's like when you wake up from the most horrific night of your life, the only solution you have is to do the same thing that caused the most horrific night of your life. But you think there's salvation in it.
And there's also something in there too, like, this time will be different. And the truth is like, it wasn't bad every time, right? Like, sometimes we're good.
Yeah.
Sometimes we're good. And I have that selective memory of like, it was fun that night. And maybe I can recreate that magic again.
Yeah. And it's so funny, like, looking back, like, I always talk to people who are like just coming into the rooms and they're like, I was having so much fun. And I was like, give me an example. They're like, oh, I was on my couch making out with this beautiful girl. And then there was drugs. And my friends were there and there's music playing. And I'm like, was it fun or was it just highly stimulating?
Right.
And they're like, whoa. And it's funny, sober, like, I have a lot of fun. You know, I'm laughing, I'm, like, working out, I'm meeting nice people, I'm connecting, I'm doing all this, like, really deep, amazing stuff. But when I was using, it was just, like, high-intensity stimulation.
Now, here's the thing, though, right? Flash forward for a second. Just because I don't drink anymore doesn't mean I still don't crave that high-intensity stimulation.
Sure, but it's sustainable.
Well, where do you find it?
I find it through connecting with other people in a really profound way. So, like, I find it through making super meaningful connections with women, particularly like dating. I mean, I don't think there's anything higher than dating. There's sexuality involved. There's, you know, intimacy. There's connecting to someone. There's nervousness. There's all this stuff, and you do it sober. And I was talking to a newcomer last night, and I was like, when you're sober, like this is the best drug. This is limitless. Mm-hmm. You're running on like high octane, God-made like humanity. Like, and it's not running out. You can be going on it all day. You can be the earliest to wake up, latest to go to sleep, and you're not like being fettered by like, you know, darkness.
Right.
And that's a pretty cool drug.
For sure. For sure. But it can be, how do I put this? My disease of addiction can manifest in all those things. Like it can addict with women, with food, with exercise, with money.
Yeah.
So how do you check yourself? Or do you just be like, hey, none of those things are going to kill me?
So I'm a big proponent, and I'm paraphrasing, but there is this in the big book of the sentiment of tackle your addictions in the order of which they kill you. Mm. So there's this story about this guy in the big book. And it says he was drinking too much coffee. He was smoking too many cigarettes. His wife would freak out at him about it. And they got in all these fights about it. Too much caffeine, too many cigarettes. And the guy relapses. Mm. So listen, that's obviously like an antiquated example. But the point is, tackle your addictions in order which they kill you. I think personally, like if I didn't have a lot of the vices I have, whether that be dating or, you know, maybe excessive exercise or, you know, maybe spending money too much here and there, I don't know if getting sober would have been as pleasant as it's been. Mm-hmm. You know, if it was, I can't, as someone who is an alcoholic and an addict and had every stimulation possible for most of his life, I don't know how I would remove all those stimulations and then have a happy, sober life. So for me, we are not saints. I like to keep a little bit of the chaos and get rid of the atomic bombs,
right?
You know, keep the chaos a little bit, but get rid of the nuclear weapons. And that's where I kind of like toe the line.
Now, when did you first get sober? How old were you?
I was 16 when I walked into my first AA meeting.
Okay. I'm guessing it wasn't your idea.
It was my idea. It was my idea because I really got drunk for the first time at 8. And after that happened, there was never a day I didn't think about drinking. I was obsessed with it. By 12.
How does an 8-year-old get drunk?
There was a party. It was a big party at like a family friend's house. I ran into a room. I grabbed a bottle of champagne. I hid it from my friends. I hid it from the parents. I grabbed a glass, ran into a guest bathroom. The bottle was open. I poured a glass glass of champagne, drank it again, 4 times. I had never seen anyone chug liquor. I'd never known how to do that. I just did it. It was in me. I was wired to suck this liquid down.
Okay.
And I got drunk, and it was the greatest night of my entire life. I've never felt so good ever. And I had a bad childhood. I was fat. I was miserable. I was unhappy. And this night was like the pinnacle. And that was at 8. And every day after that, from 8 till today, I thought about drinking. And by 12, I had alcohol poisoning for the first time.
Oh, wait, hold on. So I had an experience like that at 13, okay, where I took painkillers because I had a dental surgery. And that, for me, was like that moment. Okay, so, I mean, I have my own answer for this. But I said to you, like, what was so profound about it? What did it make you feel? What did it give you that you weren't feeling, right?
Yeah.
What was it?
You know, for me, it was twofold. The first thing was that there was a real high about being rebellious a little bit and getting, that was the initial thing about like doing something that was a little naughty. Mm-hmm. I think I craved that. And the second thing is once I had that feeling, that warmth, that, you know, that liquor in me, I was less Paul, and that was it. I was less Paul. Mm. I don't know what I was more. I was more this or I was more that, but I was less Paul. And all I wanted in life was to feel less Paul, because Paul was not happy and Paul didn't like being Paul. And being able to turn that volume down, those voices, the self-loathing, all that stuff. I mean, I was like, okay, this is the solution. Period. End of story. And if I didn't have AA, it would still be the solution.
So you walked into a room at 16.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. First impressions?
I have alcoholism in extended family at the time. And so it didn't have a stigma against it, really. I knew it was like okay to go there. I knew it was a safe place.
Some people who have families that they drink and they went to recovery, it's almost like they know their seat is waiting for them.
Right.
Was that the feeling?
Yeah, I knew it was like, it was time. I mean, I had a real substance and drinking problem at 16, like a real one.
Yeah.
Like, it was like my girlfriend at the time was in tears every day about it. Like, my family talked about it the whole time. I mean, it was an issue. Mm-hmm. So, no, I knew it was correct. And I went, and I remember sitting there, and I remember crying. And I remember people, like, not really knowing what to do with me. I was really young.
Why didn't your family send you to rehab?
They did a year later.
Okay.
Yeah. Because we are really good at hiding things. You know, we're good at, it's so funny.
We as people or we as your family?
We as like AA people.
Okay.
And historically, when I've been using or drinking, I would want to tell people enough about it that they'd feel bad for me and that they'd want to like maybe like help me stop. But I'd never let them really see behind the curtains. You know, I knew like I couldn't completely hide it and I'd want them to be sensitive to it. And I was like complex and it was part of my image and I was the bad boy and I had issues and I liked all that in some fucked up way. But if they really knew like the craziness of it, like, no.
Then... Well, the craziness for me was when I was alone.
Oh, 100%.
Like for me, it was like the weirdness was drawing the shades and finishing all the cocaine and ordering more. And suddenly it's 5 a.m. on a Tuesday. I'm going to work in 2 hours. And I'm like, how the hell did this just happen?
100%.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's not about being the bad boy. That's about like, for me, that was about the allergy of addiction.
Totally.
Right?
No, the bad boy stuff is like the visible stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. The real stuff is the behind closed doors stuff. Like, and I'm talking about like, you know, going, you know, in my like childhood bedroom, going with a tweezer into the carpet to try to pull out little stems of weed that I might have dropped to put into like tin foil because I broke the glass pipe to try to smoke in order to get, you know, half an hour of sleep.
Right.
You know, that's like the real shit.
Yeah.
You know?
We've all crawled on that carpet.
Yeah, exactly. We've all crawled on that carpet. So, yeah. And so it was like bad, but, you know, I think I got like ready. Listen, I went to like this like week. I went to like rehab at 17, but I went for a week, and it was a Band-Aid. And whilst I call a lot of my early sobriety Band-Aids, and what Band-Aids were, they're called Band-Aids and apologies. That's how I think of them. Band-Aids are, I need to get help. I'm going to get help, and it's going to be okay. And so I'd like go do that. I went to that rehab, or I'd go to a few AA meetings, or I'd go see a new psychiatrist or whatever. It's a Band-Aid, and I feel better, and then I'd go out and drink again. And apologies. Which were, I really messed up and I've offended someone and I, you know, cursed out someone or I punched someone and I want to say a big sorry in public, sorry to the world. Paul's going to go get sober now.
Right.
And everyone's going to know about it because I'm saying sorry. And then I'd go get sober for like 3 months and I said sorry and everyone forgave and now I can go out and drink and drug again.
Plus it's like a real box check of an action. Like, look at what I'm doing. Like I'm making real improvements in my life.
Totally.
Right. Okay. So when I met you, we met very briefly when I had around 8 months. We're talking 2016, early 2017. You had been sober a while at that point, right? Maybe like 4 years.
I don't know, maybe 2 years or something.
Okay. So the thing that I'm most fascinated with, right, is people's relapses.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I think sometimes that I've never really came close. I've had, you know, twinkles in between my ears and seeing something being that looks good. But you relapsed.
Yeah.
So what I always want to know is, was it the kind of thing where you woke up that day and you thought, I'm going to drink?
No.
Or it just was like, I've heard the story of like I was at a wedding, a champagne glass got put in my hand and I drank it. Which one was it?
Yeah, I can't relate to that at all. Like that, like, I mean, I party pretty hard in sobriety and I go out and I'm around, you know, alcohol and I'm around drugs and I'm around loud music and I'm around just general merriment.
Mm-hmm.
And it also says in the big book, like I'm paraphrasing and I'm sure I'm screwing this up, but what I've gotten out of it is like if you're working a really great program and you're spiritually fit, you can go to any bar or nightclub or whatever and, you know, dive into all the merriment as long as you don't pick up. And, like, that's, like, very much my thing. And it goes back to, like, if you're having, like, The only point of being sober for me, the only reason to be sober for me is if life sober is better than life not sober.
100%.
100%, yeah. Right? So if you were to like restrict me and be like, you can't go there, people, places, and things, like it wouldn't work for me because I'd be really bored and I wouldn't be having fun.
Right.
So I'm a big, so no, that's not, like if I'm working a strong program, you can put champagne glasses in my hand all day. You know, no, it's not going to, that's, I don't think 99 times out of 100, that's going to be the problem. For me, what happened is I was going hard on AA. I was like Mr. AA. And I think today, in a lot of ways, I'm Mr. AA.
What does that mean?
Mr. AA to me means putting your best, putting 110% to AA, putting it before everything else, really working the program, really practicing.
Service commitments. I mean, meetings almost every day.
Totally. Like I was.
Friendship circle in AA.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I went out. I went to a meeting I went to a meeting last night. I wanted to go home. A guy from the meeting was like, let's get dinner. I was like, absolutely. I went and got dinner with the guy. I was like, all right, time to go home. I'm walking home. A guy from the meeting from 2 hours before is walking on the street. He had shared at the meeting. He was down. I walked up to him. I talked to him for an hour and 45 minutes. And then I went home and went to sleep. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mean. Like, Mr. A means that you're showing up. You're putting it first. You're putting it like, this is like, you know, this is the thing in your life to make everything else better.
Right.
So I think when you're putting like, you know, when you're putting AA in that light in your life, like you're pretty good. Mm-hmm. What happened to me, and you know, I hear this kind of story a lot. It's like the classic story. My life, as a direct result of sobriety and Alcoholics Anonymous, got so good that I didn't need AA anymore. I had the hottest girlfriend. I had the best job. I had the best body. I had the most everything. I mean, I was like the guy mm-hmm. in my mind. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm sure I was a fucking loser, but I thought I was I thought I was cool enough where I didn't need to go to meetings anymore. You know what? It's Tuesday. I go to that Tuesday meeting every week for 3 years. Well, you know what? I'm not going to go this week because I'm going to go to this cool, you know, party or this date or whatever it is. And like, that's what I'm going to go do because I'm good. Mm-hmm. That started happening a lot.
Also, things seem more interesting than AA after a while.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I've been to this meeting a billion times, but I haven't been to this restaurant once.
100%. That month you spent, you know, crying and soul searching in rehab 3 years before, you don't really remember that. Those meetings where you like saw your sponsor after every day at the diner to do, you know, step work for that first year or whatever, you don't really remember that well. Mm-hmm. Because you and now years later, and you're like, you know, all that foundational stuff's not really there. So that happened. And then in tandem of that, I'm sure it's no coincidence, I started getting really depressed. The problem with, and I had been depressed in AA before, but this time I was.
Meaning like not just like down in the dumps, like you think clinically?
Yeah. I have some depression stuff.
Okay.
And the problem is now I was removed from AA too much and I got depressed. So I had no support system really. And I wasn't in like this great mental health warrior self that I always had been in AA, which was like seeing a psychiatrist. I had all these pillars, seeing a psychiatrist, you know, going to AA, working out. My schedule is all fucked up. So I'm depressed. I'm not going to AA. And I get really down and I know.
What does it look like when you're feeling down?
Just distracted, sometimes manic, you know, too, you know, just.
But like, I don't even really know what manic means to you at least.
Trying to perform yourself out of melancholia, like trying to like
you know, fake it till you make it to the extreme.
Yeah, like you're going to go on 30 dates instead of one. You're going to work out 10 hours instead of one, or you're not going to work out for 3 weeks because you can't, or you're going to isolate, not hang out with your friends or go on a date because you can't. Just like extreme swings of bizarre behavior.
How long does a swing last? One direction or the other?
I don't know. During that time, it was like, I don't know. It was probably 3 months it took this whole kind of up and down and distractibility and like having no foundation. It was like a 3 month thing in between like being really good, between being fine and then starting to like be like, whoa, I think I'm going to drink again.
And let me ask you this one. What, like these swings, right? When you swing from high to low, is it like turning a light switch? Is it that drastic or
no,
it's slow?
It's slow. But like the people who know you best start saying like, hey, man, like, are you OK? Like, hey, I've kind of seen this before. Are you all right? Hey, are you still going to meetings? You know, hey, are you still going to the gym? Hey, are you still seeing your shrink? Like people start seeing it, you know, you start getting unhealthy. You know, the thing is, if you're like AA, you know, elite, you're like sober SEAL Team 6, you're like Chris Kyle, like American Sniper, like AAing, like you look pretty good.
Yeah.
You sound pretty good. Like you're helping dudes, like, and ladies, like you're like a positive human.
Mm-hmm.
And like when you're like that 6 months ago, and then 6 months later, people are looking at you and you're like kind of squirrely and you're not at that meeting every week anymore. And like, you know, your body's kind of changing and, you know, you don't answer the phone calls anymore. Like people get the hint.
Okay. So how does it lead to the drink?
You know, for me, I was just like, I started getting a hate on for AA. That's like, it starts with talking shit about AA.
Right.
That's how it starts. Like, like it's lame. It's stupid. I don't believe in God. I can't even relate to that. Then you start going to meetings and like little things start annoying
you. You're looking at your phone.
Yeah. And you get annoyed. Like they say something and it's annoying. And you get these,
you know what's
like,
funny? My tell of my, like when I know I'm sort of acting unsober, my thoughts are unsober, is when everyone in an AA room is laughing at a joke except for me.
Oh, yeah. That's a big one.
Where I'm like, that wasn't funny. Why is everyone laughing?
Right. It's annoying.
Yeah.
So you get these hate-ons.
Yep.
Yeah. You start distancing yourself, and then you're like, okay, I'm not feeling good, and this AA thing isn't helping. And then it's like, I know it does. And then you're like, whoa.
Okay, so tell me about the day of the first drink. I just want to know about that first time that you looked at a drink and you thought, fuck it.
I went to an AA meeting because I was like, I know I'm going to drink today, but I'm going to go to the meeting.
It's like one last Hail Mary.
I have to try it. So I go to the meeting and I sit there and I'm like, you have to be open-minded if you go to a meeting. My mind is closed. The decision had been made. The drink was taken before the drink was taken.
Mm-hmm.
I walk out of the meeting probably 30 minutes early, maybe more, maybe even earlier. I walk out. I wander around. I'm in Midtown. I wind up at some Belgian bar. I'm not a Belgian bar kind of drinker, but that was the first bar. And I walk in and I say, I'd like a beer. And they go, what kind? And I said, I don't know, a lager, whatever. And they bring it in this like twisted, fancy glass.
Right.
And I look at this person. And I'm like, if you think I'm breaking this years long sobriety with this glass, you're out of your mind. And I walk out of the bar and I Google Irish pub and I go to First Avenue and I go to this dark pub
alone,
sweating in the heat or whatever it was. I order like three Guinnesses and three shots of Jameson, and I walk to the back of the bar and I had a journal with me and I started writing down how I felt. I don't know if I bought the journal. I don't know why I had a journal. I mean, I had something to write with, and I started writing down how I felt, and I started drinking. And then I went, and I was having, I was so depressed. I started drinking these drinks, drank all these drinks. I was so depressed. I walked out. I bumped into two friends. They went for a walk. They introduced me to a girl that they were getting drinks with. They left. The girl and I hung out a little bit. We hooked up. We drank the rest of the night. We had the best night ever, and that was it. And I was off to the races, and it was like, this is what I was meant to be doing all along.
This is what I meant to be doing.
And it was so reinforced,
no,
just
not
like that.
Not one regret.
That night, I was like, whoa.
But like in the morning? And also, okay, going back, like the infrastructure is in place. Like if I drank tomorrow, I'd have a lot of phone calls to make to people and say like, hey, I drank last night. And a lot of my friendship, not that they're contingent on my sobriety, but my sobriety helps those friendships.
Oh, they're contingent on it more than you know.
They probably are. So what, you lost friends?
Oh, yeah. You know, when you make friends in AA, like you forget, like, yeah, you guys build this great big friendship, but the foundation of the friendship is sobriety. Like the reason you guys are so deeply connected in a way that you're not with any other friends in your life is that you guys are all like a unit. I mean, you guys are like a SEAL team. Mm-hmm. And like, it's like everyone else in the world is drinking and you guys aren't together. And because, and like when there's a bad day, it's okay. Cause my best friend, Paul, or my best friend, Mike, also doesn't drink.
Mm-hmm.
So when you break that, that's like the needle in the thread of the friendship coming out.
Plus you're like, you're going off on a tributary of sort of, well, here's what I mean by that. We both live in New York City. Most people, drinking is everything. Like everything revolves in some way or shape or form around drinking, okay? But for people like us, we sort of do other things. Our time schedules, for the most part, are a little bit different. Now you're going mainstream. Okay. Oh, yeah. So like the things that you do, the interests that you have and the activities that you partake in are now not lining up with the ones that were happening with SEAL Team 6.
I think that's why people, and I'm going to ask you about this, I think that's why people say it's so hard to come back, because they know that it isn't going to be me like treading lightly in. They know the commitment that it takes, and it's daunting. You know, it's daunting. Okay, so what I want to know next is, you have the drink. You were out there for 2 years?
I think two and a half, 2 years, yeah.
Okay. In that time, how long did it take for you to go back to like the Paul that was sent to rehab, the Paul that was out of control? How long did it take for you to be like, holy shit, this is out of control?
I'm going to tell you, this answer should tell you more than it tells you. I don't remember.
Right.
I mean, here's the thing. It's hard for me to timeline it, because once you pick up that drink, the only thing that exists in life is that drink. The first thing is, okay, I need to control this. I better not get out
of
hand.
Right.
And all you're doing is thinking about it. So like you're going to like work drinks, and for the first time that you ever went to work drinks at that job, you're going to have a beer.
Is any part of you thinking, I'm different, I can't control this, I got this?
Maybe like you want, of course you want to think that.
I know, but do you believe your own shit?
You do until you buy drugs for the first time.
Right.
You believe it until like you kind of turn to the guy who like has the blow and you're like, all right, give me a bump. He's like, but you literally have told me like you don't want to do it. And you're like, yeah, I know I do though. And he's like, all right, cool, no problem. And, you know, because that guy doesn't give a shit. And then you do that, and then you're like,
there's no going back.
And then you're like, okay, wait, more. And then you're like, then you're the guy like grinding his teeth. And then you haven't done that in years. And then you're like, oh, okay, it's back.
Yeah.
But then, you know, that's what they call it, addiction. You know, once it's back, you don't care. You want more of it. And it sounds so crazy sitting here sober to say, why would you want more of being the guy grinding his teeth in the corner of the whatever? That's it. As soon as you do it, you want more. And all logic and reason and, you know, whatever goes out the window.
Okay. So that took 2 years of that.
Yeah.
But it all culminates in what?
It all culminates in I fell in love. She invites me to stay with her parents for a weekend. And I bring drugs, and I hide booze in their basement, and I get annihilated during a family dinner with her beautiful, amazing family, who I loved. And she, you know, I leave the next day, and she calls me, and she says, "Listen, like, do we even need to discuss this? Like, it's over." Mm. And that was the last day I ever drank.
That was 9 months ago,
right? Yeah, almost 10 months ago. Yeah.
So now, I mean, I see you all the time now. Now you are going, you have gone full in. You're back in.
Oh, yeah. I'm back.
Okay. So I want to, these next few questions are going to be about step work, and you can address it from the first round or the second round. It doesn't matter.
All right. Okay? I wanted to say something very specifically. When I got sober this time around, I did something different that I'd never done before.
Which was what?
I'd gone away somewhere for a week when I was 17. But this time, I went to rehab for 2 months.
Which one?
I left there, and then I like dived into AA in a way that I've never dived into AA. So when you said, will you answer it like based on now or back then? Mm-hmm. My step work, I feel like, really began this time I got sober.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, like big time.
First time around, it wasn't like you hadn't done the amends really.
You know what? I did some of the action steps. You know what the big difference was? I thought the higher power stuff was bullshit. First time, and I talked about that day and night the first time I got sober. When I was like in my way early 20s, I was like, this higher power stuff is nonsense, I don't believe in God, da 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 da. And I didn't realize that it's a God. I couldn't understand this. This is a God of your understanding.
Okay,
this is a huge big God. This is a huge hula hoop to jump through.
So when did you have this? I don't want to call it a white light moment, but you know what I mean.
I had like a white light moment, spiritual necessary way. I was in this kind of class at rehab, and they were talking about how we have 1,000 voices in our head. And I went for a walk after on my own, and I was like, okay, I'm that guy. I have 1,000 voices in my head at all times. You know, go do this, cheat on this, you know, run over here, quit this job, yell at this person, curse here, whatever it is. I have 1,000 voices in my head. But wait a second, I'm a good guy. Why do I do all this bad shit? Why have I done all this bad stuff all my life? And I sat quietly and I was like, wait a second. There's this like one really calm, still voice that if I like sit quietly and meditate or pray, whatever, the book kind of uses the two synonymously, mm-hmm. and I like listen, like guidance and the right direction, that good orderly direction, God comes. And I was like, whoa, that works for me. And so when I sit and pray and I have this real dilemma or something and I like really listen, I listen to that calm, still voice, whatever it is, maybe it's my conscience, maybe it's this, maybe it's something to do with spiritual, whatever, that guidance comes and that I found my higher power in. Mm. And that was like a big moment for me. And I was like, whoa, okay.
So how do you carry that moment and keep it? Because it's easy. I've had fleeting moments like that, but if I don't work it, that's what they are. They're fleeting. So how do you maintain it?
On like a very basic, quick level, I'd almost say, like, trust your gut. Like, if you are proactively living a really good, healthy life and you're helping people and you're being positive, and you're going to meetings, doing all this stuff, and you're talking about what we're talking about right now, you're, like, living in the light. Mm-hmm. It's like, not to be hokey, but you're living in, like, a good life. Mm-hmm. And when you're living a good life and you're, like, you know, have that momentum, like, you're doing good things. And when you think bad thoughts or want to do bad things, it punches you in the stomach and lets you know that's not the right move, man.
Right.
And even if you do those things afterwards, it's like, you better fix that, dude. That was not the right move. And that's that voice, you know, it's whatever you want to call it. Trust your gut, God consciousness, your conscience, whatever. That's HP to me.
Right. It's that feeling in your stomach that you know when you're either have done or are about to do something that you know is wrong.
Totally.
Right.
And the problem is we get so good at numbing ourselves and not listening to it. So we have to practice listening to it, you know? And we can be, it's so funny, like morals and values and even the gut, they're so malleable. You want to live like an animal, you can live like an animal. You know, you want to not feel stuff, sure, take drugs and alcohol. Or you know what? You don't even need drugs and alcohol. You just act like a piece of shit. You can go do that. But if you start acting as if, and people start saying, why don't you do service commitment? Or why don't you go talk to that guy who's struggling? And you force yourself to go do that stuff, you're going to feel pretty damn good.
Do you have an amends that does stick out?
Yeah. An amends I made that worked out.
Didn't work out. I can tell you amends that stick out that didn't work out. And I think they're just as important to tell. But do you have one, a story, either way, that sticks out?
Absolutely. This is like the most dramatic one, but it's a huge one. I got really drunk and high at a public, very public space at a big, like a lunch spot that like all, I knew so many people there and it was like open, it was outdoors, it was beautiful, it was during the day, it was on a Saturday. It's like a huge table of like 12 of my friends, girls and guys, and I am really fucked up. This guy at the table, this nice, cool guy, makes a joke about me. It makes a joke at me. Something about like me and this girl I was seeing and, you know, her like flirting with someone. It's a nothing joke. Just a ball-busting joke. Mm-hmm. And I punch him in the face.
Like you reached over the table and
table and hit this kid in the face. And like, we're like from, you know, polite society, like, you know, like these are like...
You're not like a fighter. I know you. It's not really in your nature.
This is like, we're like, you know, college educated and like, you know, everyone's in, like, you know, a nice, like, you know, these are nice, like, wholesome, more or less innocent people.
Right.
And I punch this guy in the face in front of all these people. And people just stopped. And this kid looked at me and he was like, you are an animal. You need to get it together. You're disgusting, man. And I left. And my best friends were there. And they were like, dude, you got to get the fuck out of here. This is too much. So I get sober like a few months later or whatever, and this is the first time I came to
okay.
And I like a year later, finally, because I'd been avoiding this amends like the plague, and my sponsor's like, you got to do it. So I call the guy, I hadn't spoken to him in like a year and a half at that point. The last time I saw him, I punched him in the face, and I said, listen, I, you know, I'm, it's, you know, it's Paul. I'm a year or whatever sober, and every day I think about what I did to you, and it's, I carry this shame around me every day, and I don't even know how to make it up to you, but I want to apologize from the bottom of my heart. It changed my life that happened, and I am so sorry. And she said, "You're sober?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "How is it?" I said, "It's amazing." He said, "Dude, I'm so proud of you, man. That's amazing." And we got lunch and we hung out. And to this day, we're like, you know, we're not best friends, but we're friends.
Right.
And, you know, years have gone by now and it's like never brought up. And if it ever was, it would be laughed about. And it's like done and over. But the point is, that year of not making amends, I thought about that stuff and lived in like such horrific pain and shame about that behavior. And the fact that I got sober to this guy was an acceptable apology.
Right.
And that was like a miracle.
And to me, here's the difference between living in addiction and having a program sort of as a wind in your back. For me, if I did that to that guy, what I would have done is I would have said, the running dialogue would have been, he deserved it. He had it coming. Mm-hmm. No regrets.
Yeah.
And anyone that doesn't understand that, they're against me too.
Right.
And that was one of the major reasons that everything whittled away for me, right? The friendship circle whittled down to like the hardcore user friends, the girlfriends and the dating all whittled away. Because in the end, I had this distorted view of things, which is everyone's crazy except for me.
Right. Yeah, we justify everything.
Right. We justify everything. So we're butting up against the end, but I want to ask you two more.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it might be three. So the first one is there anything that you heard first time or second time around, whether it be in a qualification or in a share, that it just like really stuck out to you, that like you heard it and you were like, wow, like that was profound?
AA is like getting a $200,000 education shoved up your ass one nickel at a time.
Who said that?
My buddy Neil said that.
We're good.
My buddy Neil said that.
Okay.
And he said that at a qualification, and everyone laughed, and everyone went home and thought about it. And the point is, this is the most valuable education of your life. So, I mean, college, grad school, whatever, this is the most valuable education of your life. But it's work, and it's hard, and it's not, you know, all like rainbows and butterflies. This is digging deep. This is inventorying. This is like really self-examining. This is turning your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand him. This is like big, big stuff. And it's not easy. Mm. And it's not always fun. But what you get out of it is priceless. I mean, this is it. You want to be a superhero? I told this guy last night, you want to be a fucking superhero? Get sober, you know?
So these are the last two. Usually I ask someone, I said, give me the best piece of advice for someone that has trying to get to 90 days, right? That real struggle to get to 90, which is certainly what I had. So, but first, what's the piece of advice that you would give to someone who is in your situation, someone that was fading away from the program, who was in there, SEAL team, and now was fading? What would you say to them that would sort of like reinvigorate it?
Hang on for dear fucking life. Hang on for dear fucking life. Now, sorry. Okay. Retrospect. Hang on for dear fucking life. The truth is, it gets so much worse than it ever was when you relapse after a few years of sobriety. It gets so much worse. So if you hate AA and you're doing all that stuff, I don't know, man. Check yourself. You know what? You know what I should have done?
What?
Checked into fucking rehab.
When you felt it happening.
When I felt it happening, I should have gone away. And I should have gone away and said, listen, I have 3 years sober, but I'm about to fucking relapse. I need a crash course. That's what I should have done. And actually, if I were to be in that position again, I'd immediately go back to rehab. And I'd go spend a month there, and I'd get the crash course, and I'd do the dig deep, and I'd get back into AA, and then I'd come back home.
Last one. Best piece of advice to someone trying to get to 90 days, what would it be?
If point A is your first day in AA and point B is 90 days, you just have to get from A to B. So I wish you could just close your eyes and B would come. Because on 90 days, or even before then, as time passes, you will feel better. The insane hangover on day one will go away. The insane memory of the thing you just did to get you into AA the next day is going to, like, you're going to be like, oh, okay, this stuff isn't as bad as I thought. This stuff gets better, but the time is so important. You got to let that time pass.
It's funny. So I talk about this too, but I don't hear a lot of people say that. So I'm with you. You should be collecting days like people collect fucking stamps or whatever. Just, you got to collect the time. And so for me, right, and like I think they would never say this in an AA meeting, but I like would go to bed at 9 o'clock and I would swig ZQL because I'm like, I need to close a chapter on this day right now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Next day needs to come.
Next day needs to come right now. Okay. So like, fine. Maybe I didn't need a ZQL addiction, nor did I adapt one. But like you said, you got to go with what's the hottest flame. Kill the hottest flame.
Oh, yeah.
So collecting those days.
You got to let the days go by.
Yep.
Get busy. If that's sitting in 5 AA meetings a day, sit in 5 AA meetings a day. If that's jerking off 12 times a day and then sitting in 5 AA meetings, you need to let the days go by, because the horror and anxiety and misery and self-loathing that made you go into AA goes away as time passes. But time has to pass. And the less time passes, the more you're going to want to drink and do drugs to make that stuff feel better. The more time passes, the less you need those drinks and do drugs, so you feel better. So that's the first thing. You got to let the time pass. And you got to, like, grin and bear it. And you got to know it's not, like, going to be alleviated on day three or whatever. Mm-hmm. Maybe it will. But, like, the point is you got to let the time pass. The next thing is you got to go to meetings. And, like, that 90 and 90 thing, like, it sounds like, you know, whatever. But, like, the point is, like, if you sit in a meeting for an hour a day, at least one, which ends up being like an hour and a half because you're there 15 minutes early, you talk to guys after, you go to the diner, whatever it is, you're probably not going to drink right after that. You're definitely not going to drink during that. And before then, you're probably not going to drink because you're heading to one. Mm-hmm. And so that's like a 3-hour time period of the day that you're probably not going to drink. And that's huge. You throw 2 or 3 of those in, that's 9 hours of the day you're probably not going to drink. Then you sleep. The day goes by.
Right.
So go to the meetings and stay close to the sober guys. You're not annoying anyone. The other thing you need to know is like people, I think, come into AA and they're like, I don't want to call this person. Like, they might
I'm
be
bothering
busy.
Them.
I'm bothering
right.
them. That's
you're
no, you're not bothering anyone.
You're actually making their day. They want you to call them.
100%. So like, call these people and like, be superficial if you want. Find like the sexiest, coolest dude in the room, or like the hottest chick if you're a girl, that you want to be like and you want to emulate. Call that person. I did that. I like had like a guy crush on this dude. I was like, this guy wears a suit. He looks so cool. He runs this, da 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 da. And I like literally hassled this guy 24/7. The guy became like my best friend. And like, you know, that's how I got sober. He invited me to his house to watch the Super Bowl. And I was like, never been invited to go anywhere in the last like for years prior, because I was like this total fuck up. And if you dive in the first 90 days, you feel good things happen. You start feeling good. You hang out with guys. You feel better. Like, just keep fucking going.
My thanks again to Paul H. for coming on the show. This has been another episode of Keep Coming Back, Real Stories of Sobriety and Recovery. Again, my name is Mike S., and I will see you next week.